Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage.
This is CG Garage,
episode number 36.
36.
Featuring 36. Kevin Bailey. And we have as our guest in the intro today, Mr. David Tracy.
Hello,
David. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So before we get started, a little bit of something we want to talk about is we are going to be at Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn.
Yes.
And it's a fantastic event. We're very excited to be there. Unfortunately, the event is completely sold out. So if you'd like to see Trojan Horse or participate a little bit, you can still do that using going to Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn TV. And to do that, go to trojan-unicorn.com/TV, and if you go there and enter the promo code THU-CHAOS33, you'll get a 33% discount.
So you can watch it and you get a discount to watch it. What if you just like show up? What if I just show up? I'm just like, hey, come on.
If you just show up,
I'm in Portugal.
I think it's kind of booked. I think like you can't actually go anywhere. Like there's no room. It's like the hotels are all booked up. I mean, you won't be able to find, you'll have to sleep on the street.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of sucks. But anyway, this is Kevin Bailey. So Kevin Bailey is really pretty much, he's from the future.
He is from the future, absolutely.
Because what he is doing is, while everyone's saying, yeah, the cloud is going to happen at some point, we're going to figure out how to run our cloud, he is doing it. Not only is he doing it, he's been doing it for 5 years. He rendered an enormous amount of work on Robert Zemeckis' new film, The Walk, on the cloud, like 600 shots or so, all on Google Cloud, using V-Ray for Cortana. And he explains to us not only how he did it, but how it's economically cheaper to do it that way. It's a really interesting talk. I really want to get down there. If anyone has any questions about whether it's possible to render on the cloud, what the MPA has to say, or what anything else is going to be, this podcast helps answer a lot of these real big questions, which I'm sure you guys are very interested in. And if you're interested in finding out more about V-Ray for Cortana, we talked about that as well.
I mean, he's done his homework. I mean, he worked on Flight, right?
I think he did Flight with Zemeckis as well. He's done a bunch of other things as well. But, I mean, he's really just like, I'm going to do it all in the cloud. Get rid of my render farm. No render farm. So it's really kind of an amazing thing that he's been doing. And the stuff on The Walk is incredible. I mean, we're talking like 600 or so shots, all replacing most of New York, all CG. So it's pretty incredible work. So really, really cool to see. Anyway, thanks, David, for coming.
Yeah, I really added a lot to this conversation, didn't I?
Yep,
that's who we're talking to today.
Thank you, David.
Enjoy, folks.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
We are good. Have you done a podcast before?
I don't know if I've done a podcast before.
Really?
Done hundreds of interviews, but I don't think I've ever done a podcast.
Yeah. Well, the podcasts that we do are very casual, very conversational. They tend to run a little bit long, which is why they get good.
Okay.
Because we actually end up having real meaningful conversation. I'm not just trying to get a specific quote from you. I'm actually trying to get some stories from you.
Great.
So let's start with that. So let's talk about your stories.
My career?
Well, last night was a pretty good. Yeah. Did you go to Lighter Darker last night?
I did, yeah.
Oh, that's what happened to me, too.
That's a good party.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good party. Do you... So, San Francisco.
Yeah.
That's your home.
That is my home.
You've been there for a long time, the Bay Area, right?
Yeah, I've been in the Bay Area for, I think, almost 20 years now. So I grew up in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you've been totally a West Coast guy.
I've been a West Coast guy. Yeah, I definitely am. My brother's on the East Coast right now, and it's driving him crazy.
Really?
Yeah. Nothing against the East Coast, but when we spend that long on the West Coast, you kind of becomes a part of you.
Yes, it does. I guess so. I mean, I grew up actually in a foreign country for a long time.
Yeah.
And then
when I would ever come to the U.S., it was always like New York. It was like New York was because that's where I was. So told New York person. And when I moved to Texas, it was like I was moving to a different country at that point.
Yeah. So, that's not too far from the truth.
Yeah. Yep. And then I moved to L.A. And again, it's the same experience.
Awesome.
So when you moved to San Francisco and you started working visual effects, where did you work?
Well, I was lucky enough, like even back in Seattle, I went to high school in Seattle, obviously, and ended up working with Microsoft up there.
Oh, okay.
And because my buddy Ryan and I, who I've known since I was like 7 years old, we were just being computer animation nerds at the time. Our high school drafting teacher, he had a copy of 3D Studio released 2 for DOS. And he was like, yeah, you guys are free to use it. I don't know anything about it, but here's the manual. Go knock yourself out.
I think that's what I started on. That was my first.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It was that and Wavefront. Mm. We had that at Rice, and it was
nice.
Just, yeah.
Yeah, the Wavefront was too much for the school.
Oh, it was it was so expensive and so hard to use, and it was like, ugh.
Yeah.
And then 3D Studio was great.
Yeah, it was awesome. And we'd seen Jurassic Park, and we're like, oh, yeah, you have this software that lets us do things like that. I mean, you know. Obviously, we're at a much lower level then, but we started using it to like make videos for high school assemblies and stuff like that. And one thing led to another, and the superintendent of the high school's like husband referred us to this guy at Microsoft, and they said, "Hey, you know, come work for us." So we were 16, working at Microsoft, and then we got filmed for a documentary about like you know school to career kind of situations and. Also using technology in schools to like help improve the educational process.
Mm-hmm.
And so our school was like a really good example of that. And it just so happens that that documentary was funded by George Lucas and his educational foundation. So George saw us in this documentary in the editing room and his producer, Rick McCallum, called us one day and he was like, "Hey, how'd you guys like to come down to Skywalker Ranch and check it out?"
And yeah, we like, and you're like 16. Yeah,
I was like, let me think about that for a second. So we did that, and they gave us the e-ticket tour of ILM. They showed us like a bunch of stuff that was unreleased. We got to visit Skywalker Ranch. I babysat George Lucas's kids for an afternoon. It was like the craziest freaking experience, right?
Wow.
And so they didn't offer us a job at that point.
How long were you there for? Like a few days?
Yeah, it was like 2 days. And we stayed on the ranch and the caretaker's cottage. And it was just like, it was an absurd experience.
Yeah. That's like going to the chocolate factory, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So it was, it was total mind blown moment. So we went back home and we were like, we have no choice in life but to work there.
Right. So that's your goal now.
That was our goal. And, you know, I'd gotten accepted to Stanford and whatever. I was like, I'd previously been convinced that I wanted to be a lawyer. Thank God that didn't happen. So we were like, yeah, we have to do this. And so we worked on a project that kind of emulated the pod race from episode 1 because we'd seen the very early previs from that.
Okay.
So we're like, we need to prove that we can do stuff like this so they will give us a job.
Right.
So we sent them videotapes and letters every single month, you know, again and again, and just bugging the crap out of Rick McCallum. And finally, we get a phone call a couple weeks before we graduate from high school that says, "Quit mailing me, quit sending me videos. You got the freaking job."
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, a couple days after high school, we moved down to San Francisco to work on Star Wars Episode 1 as previs artists.
Wow. Okay. And so, right. So, previs artists. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you're just basically doing previs on it. What was the first sequence you worked on?
First sequence we worked on was part of the space battle sequence towards the end of the film.
Right.
They were shooting the movie while we were doing the previs, so anything that needed like you know real like footage, we didn't get our hands on until later. But it was a really cool process because we got to work directly with George Lucas and the editors on the film, Martin Smith and Ben Burtt.
Right.
And they would like cut together these little rip reels of World War II footage of dogfights and stuff like that.
That's what they love to do, I guess.
Yeah.
That's great.
And then, so I think Ryan and I each got to design like 800 shots for the film by the end of the day.
Yep.
And so, yeah, as 18-year-old kids working on the ranch, designing shots for Star Wars, it was
I think that's the thing epic. that some people don't necessarily see previs as very like interesting because I think it's just rough and dirty and whatever. But previs is you get to work so directly with directors.
Yeah.
You get to make what is going to be there. Eventually, it's all going to be polished up and pretty and everything mm-hmm. else. But you're the person that's there making the choices of how these shots are going to go, working with editorial, working with directors.
That's
absolutely really
right.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the soul of a movie. I was just talking to Chris Edwards and Joshua Sung from The Third Floor yesterday over lunch. And I was kind of telling him, I was like, you guys were smart, you know, because all of us that were doing previews at the time, we desperately wanted to do final shots. We wanted to have our pixels on the movie screen.
Right, of course.
And so we kind of took the first chance we had to go from previs into doing final shots for movies. And now looking back, I mean, you know, you look at a company like The Third Floor, and they built this sort of empire where they're working on, like, you know, just tons of projects
yep.
and really helping to work directly with directors to do the creative part of it. So
yeah, they have direct relationships with directors.
Yeah,
right?
Designing shots and whatever. So I firmly believe that, you know, if anybody has directorial aspirations, you know, the previous way is going to be a far more direct path to that than going the visual effects.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, really, really, really couldn't agree more. But so you were working basically at ILM for a while then mm-hmm. at that point. Were you doing mostly previs, or were you doing other things as well after that?
We were doing previs, and then once we were done with the previs on the film, we actually jumped in and did a bunch of lasers and lightsabers and C-3PO rig removal, which was a nightmare.
Really?
So, yeah, I mean, it was just countless hours of rotoscoping to get rid of the guy that was standing. There was a guy in a black suit standing behind C-3PO, uh-huh. who was see-through at that point. He doesn't have his, like, you know, his golden armor on yet.
Okay.
So it was just like individual wires, you know, left, right, and center. And it was,
I didn't realize it was a person there. I thought it was actually CG, but it's a lot of painting.
That was child labor.
Child labor. Yeah. Well, sorry to hear that, but I think you paid your dues at this point.
Yeah, I always like to say that I don't trust anyone in this business who hasn't done rotoscoping or a match move.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yep, indeed.
Yeah, so that's what we did, I think it was a great learning ground for us because we got to really be generalists.
Okay, and how did that sort of transition into you starting Atomic Fiction?
Well, there were several years in between. I think
fast forwarding quite a bit.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, we. From Lucasfilm, we started working with The Orphanage, a bunch of guys.
Right.
Stu Mashowitz, Scott Stewart, and Jonathan Rothbard. They spun off and started their own thing. And so Ryan and I were the first two employees with them.
Because
we'd kind of worked together a little bit. They were part of the Rebel Mat group at ILM. And,
yep.
and so we said, yeah, you guys are doing this thing, and we want to do this thing, and this is going to be awesome. So
did you work on Day After Tomorrow as well?
Yeah.
I
worked on Day After up there.
I just want you to know that a lot of those buildings, I modeled.
That's awesome.
Because you got those buildings too.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And we made good use of them.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so Ryan and I were the first two employees at The Orphanage and kind of got to see that shop grow to about 200 people. Mm-hmm. But all the growth was really on the backs of shows. They didn't have much investment to speak of or anything like that.
Okay.
And it was a great, great place because we couldn't, like, you know, afford the super senior talent, but we were getting, like, you know, small chunks of big shows.
Sure.
And so I was, like, you know, 25 years old and able to, you know, VFX soup on a Harry Potter movie, right?
Right.
So it was, like, crazy, like I would never have been able to get an opportunity like that anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. And The Orphanage is, you know, was pretty cool. Like,
yeah.
They did some really amazing work, and they had a little bit of an unusual workflow. They were using, you guys were using Brazil at some point, right?
Yeah.
And that was kind of like, yeah, all right. And that was when people was like, I remember someone telling me, it's like, if you're not using RenderMan, you're failing. And I was like, why? And then it's like, you know, oh, someone's like, no one's ever been fired for using RenderMan. And I was like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So doing something like using Max and Brazil at the time was kind of like, you know, kind of ballsy, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we definitely had, we had a lot of tools that we used there. I mean, we were, you know, in Maya using Air and Mental Ray, and then we had 3ds Max and Brazil. And,
yep. You're comping in like After Effects or something, weren't you?
Yeah. We were comping in After Effects
yeah,
and then
exactly.
Fusion for a while and then Nuke. But we had, and it was great because we had kind of different teams that, within the studio that were really, you know, proponents and of those particular tool sets.
Right.
Like, you know, one of my friends, Shadi Amasazada, he was like the Brazil champion.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were other people that were like, hey, we want to make the Maya workflow work. And so we had all these like kind of almost competing pipelines within the company that were well suited to doing different kinds of work.
Gotcha. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how long were you at the orphanage then?
I was at the orphanage for 7 years. Then Doug Chang, who was the previous head of the art department on Star Wars Episode One, started a company called Image Movers Digital.
Over in Portland.
Yeah, and it was actually in Novato, which is just north San Francisco Bay, area.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah, it was on an old Air Force base. You know, these two giant hangars.
Yep.
And it was Disney, Robert Zemeckis, and Doug Chang. And so Doug and I got to talking about it, and I'm like, hey, I'm ready for a bit of a change. And honestly, like one thing that really attracted me to that was like they had, you know, this Disney money, right?
Right.
So just all the money in the world. And the orphanage had been we'd been forced to be pretty scrappy and couldn't really make long-term, you know, technology and development decisions there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was one of the first non-art department employees at Image Movers, and we grew to, I don't know, it was like, at one point, I think we were over 600 between the Bay Area and LA.
Yeah.
learned a ton about mocap and just like the interesting thing there was is like we saw that we had all this money, right? So we could buy, like, we had a, you know, 14,000 square foot data center that we just like, you know, stacked with processing power and storage and all that kind of stuff. And we could hire the best of the best people from all over the world. And so there were really good aspects of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a lot of waste that we saw while we were doing it, right?
Okay.
So, you know, I think there were 2 days the entire time I was there that the render farm was utilized 24 hours a day.
Right.
So it was like,
that was kind of your inspiration towards your business model now.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Because both of those ways of working are broken, right? It's like, you know, not having enough resources really sucks and it makes people work tons of overtime and cut corners. Having too many resources is just
you're burning money.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, probably one of the reasons why Disney decided, we don't want to continue this, we want to shut it down.
So when they
decided to shut it down, Ryan and I, we kind of like thought long and hard and said, well, we could go and, you know, do visual effects supervising freelance,
mm-hmm.
or we could try to build something that's like, avoids all these pitfalls that we've seen at these two companies,
right.
And embodies all the good things that we've seen at all the places that we've worked.
So you did do something pretty different, and it was the first thing, obviously, when you guys are doing it, it's like, you know, it's almost like that's your motto or your thing.
Yeah.
It's like, we're not just a normal visual effects company. We're doing things differently right from the start. And I think it freaks out a lot of people, to be honest. Not that I think they're wrong, very wrong, because it's like, yes, I know you agree, but it freaks them out because like, no, that doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. So let's talk about quickly what your business model is and how it works and why you're doing what you're doing. And then we'll talk about all the questions and the naysaying.
Cool. Yeah. Awesome. So our business model has been from the very beginning, one that really puts the artists that are with us first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds obvious, and a lot of people will say that they do that. It's just what we're doing behind the scenes to make sure that we can come through on that.
Mm-hmm.
That makes the difference. So the biggest difference and the most obvious one and the one that we like to talk about a lot is that we use cloud computing to do all of our rendering.
Right.
So we don't have a local data center.
You basically don't have a render farm.
Yeah.
Your render farm goes on the cloud.
Yeah.
And you use either Amazon or Google or whatever cloud, right? And so you just basically just put your frames out there onto strange people's computers.
Yep.
Not knowing what's going to happen, and then hopefully you'll get a frame back and you'll just get a bill in the mail, right?
Yep, exactly. I mean, we know what's going to happen.
I know, but that's basically the thing. It's like people are like, how are you going to do this? No, you know. So, but okay, let's talk about what you have to invest in at this point, because there's still some cost. You have to invest in a big internet pipe, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have, so you don't need as big of an internet pipe as people think.
Okay.
If you're smart about how you deal with data. We, for example, on the upcoming Robert Zemeckis movie, The Walk, we had about 75 terabytes of data generated and in kind of transferred back and forth in the cloud. So it's a lot of data. Mm-hmm. And we had two studios, one in Oakland, one in Montreal. Those are two kind of artist offices.
Okay.
They had a 1 gig pipe, right?
That's it.
So it's not like we had to go out and get like, you know, a 10 gig or a 100 gig pipe or anything like that.
Right.
Each office had a 1 gig pipe and we were able to do all the work, and we had, you know, deep compositing that was used on a bunch of shots. So
yep,
like, you
that's
know,
a
big,
lot of data.
Yeah. Big amounts of data. But we did have to create our own cloud rendering platform to be able to do that, right?
Sure.
Because okay. there wasn't. You're
inventing it anyway, so
yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. there's other people that are, you know, working hard on making it work too. Like, you know, the Thinkbox guys with Deadline, right. they're taking a different approach than we are. But
sure.
So it's cool that there's a bunch of people that are working on this problem,
right? But specifically, I mean, you guys are sort of leading the field in terms mm-hmm. of this. So it's hard for you to just take an out of the box tool because no one else is doing it.
That's right.
In a sense. So you're the first guys doing it. So it makes sense that you guys want to develop your own tools and you're looking at your own pitfalls and mm-hmm. and dealing with your own process, right? Because you're kind of inventing this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And even, you know, to date, I mean, we're super proud because like all, like in any press release you read about any cloud rendering stuff, like all of the projects that have been done that are high profile in the cloud are all right. ones at Atomic Fiction just sort of like, you know, kind of almost blindly leaped into and said, we're going to use the cloud on these. And,
sure.
you know, it worked out. So we're super proud that we've been able to not just been able to do it, but also been able to talk about it to, right. you know, help make people feel like, yeah, this is okay. It's not just okay, but it's a really freaking good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, well, first of all, I think it's a really good idea. I think that there is a lot of things that people have questions about that they don't understand. Like one, like you just said, well, how am I going to get all this data back and forth,
yeah.
right? So there are smart tools to do that. There's smart mm-hmm. ways of caching data. There's smart ways of storing data on mm-hmm. the cloud that you're going to reuse, mm-hmm. right? So
absolutely.
So you have over – how long have you been rendering on the cloud right now?
Five years.
5 years. So yeah. over the last 5 years, you guys have been sort of figuring out what's the most efficient way to cache things. How long mm-hmm. is it going to take to send something there, and how long is it going to take to send something back?
Yep.
The actual rendering part is like trivial, right? Because you just pretty much put every frame on a computer.
Yeah.
You're not sitting there like, okay, I'm going to have 10 frames at a time. I'm going to have to wait all night.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we on the walk, we regularly had, you know, 10 to 15,000 cores running. There wasn't a day that we got in the morning and all the renders weren't done, right?
Right. I mean,
it's the first project that a lot of people on that show had ever worked on that they're like, oh, I actually don't have to worry about getting my
rendering done. The concept of waiting for renders is kind of gone away.
Yeah,
right?
it's going away. And yeah. the thing that's still challenging with that is even while you're rendering, the one non-trivial part is that when you have that many machines hitting disk, you need to make sure that the performance of your sort of like core sort of network and storage infrastructure in the mm-hmm. cloud is up to snuff. So there's a lot of tools that help to make that as good as it possibly can be.
Right.
But there are tools that are very foreign to a lot of visual effects, you know, technology people.
I mean, okay.
Most all of them, right? Because they're tools that, you know, the cloud has been pretty widely adopted on the web side of things, obviously.
Of course.
And so, you know, there's tools out there that, you know, if you worked at Yelp or Airbnb or something, mm-hmm. you would be familiar with. But in the visual effects community, it's just like
no one knows about that. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So, you know, we actually hired a few people from the web backend side of it
gotcha.
To come in and work side by side with VFX savvy developers to create our cloud rendering platform.
Okay.
Which is called Conductor.
Conductor, yep. Right. And Conductor is really cool. So, but you must also have been, besides, you must have been working very closely with people at like Google and Amazon too,
yep.
because was there a learning process for them as well?
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really interesting question. You know, we're working with Google right now, and
right.
and they've been really eager to work with us and have us beta test new stuff. They're like, hey, we're releasing this thing, and mm-hmm. like, you know, we jump in and test it and give them feedback. And
right.
You know, it's actually been a great process and working, you know, in the beginning we were like, oh yeah, Google, they're going to be like this, you know, giant corporation that it's just going to be, they're just going to give us stuff and we're going to have to figure out what to do with it. But mm-hmm. it's been a great relationship with those guys.
Well, that's really cool. That's really cool. So you mentioned in your talk yesterday about some of the costs of this and what you're figuring things out.
Yep.
And so one of the examples you said is that a lot of people think, well, it doesn't cost, it'll cost more than it will if I just have it. If I already have a bunch of computers, it's going to cost a bunch of money. So can you sort of verbally break down some of those ideas of like what it takes to actually own a render farm versus renting one or doing whatever you're doing?
Yeah. So the first mistake that people make when they're doing the sort of is the cloud affordable calculations is that they say, a beefy render node, it's like $6,000, right? So, and if I take a cloud instance and I run it 24/7, 365 for the useful life of the equivalent of that hardware machine, it's like $52,000 or something like that. So it's just like, okay, well, obviously 6,000 versus 52, like the cloud's way too expensive, right? Mm-hmm. But then you look at things like, well, it's not really $6,000 for that local machine because you got to power it, you got to have space for it, you got to have people maintaining it, you have to, you know, all of the cool it, all that stuff. So that 6,000 actually becomes more like between 16 and 18,000 over the course of the useful life of that machine.
Which is about 3 years, right?
Yeah, between 3 to 5 is usually people's like, you know, turnaround cycle.
Don't put me on a 5-year old machine.
I know. I just lots of people do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, then, but still, you know, 18,000 versus 52, it's still really off. But then you take into account things like, you know, when people go home on the evening and their renders finish by 6 a.m. and then they don't submit renders again until 10 a.m. So that's like a big gap in the
10
day.
10 a.m. if you're lucky, sometimes people don't submit renders till the end of the day. So the machines are not always working.
No, so, you know, they're, and we've talked to a lot of sort of medium to large size visual effects companies, and ones over the course of a year, ones that are really big and really busy all the time, they aim for a 50% utilization of their farm.
Right.
Ones that are smaller and have kind of spikier workloads where it's like they do asset development on a show and then they render and then they're back into asset mode and then they render. Mm-hmm. So throughout the year, they're looking at, you know, between a 15 and a 25% utilization.
Right.
Right. So if you look at that and you say, well, with the cloud, I'm only paying for what I'm using.
Right.
And let's just take 50% as our utilization target.
Right.
That all of a sudden the numbers become very, very comparable.
Right.
And then, you know, and then you're looking at like, well, artists get stuff back faster and so they can actually be more productive, you know, with the idea of being fresher in their head. And also the price of the cloud is going down year by year by year, historically mm-hmm. about 30% year over year. So if you are locked into, you know, you buy local hardware now, you're locked into that price for 4 years, right?
And it's just going to get slower and crappier.
Yeah, whereas the cloud is not only getting cheaper, it's getting upgraded on 6-month cycles, right? So it's becoming faster and cheaper as time goes on.
Right.
So when you look at it, after all of, like, taking all those things into account, the price of using a cloud instance over the course of, you know, 4-year lifespan is actually more like $6,000 to $8,000.
Right.
So it is less than half the price of the true cost of owning local hardware.
And you've actually shown that, right? So you basically, like, on the walk, you were showing statistically, like, if I had to buy all the computers to do this, it would have cost $2.2 million or something like that.
It would have been $2.2 million in lease and space and electricity payments and support over the course of the 8 months that we did the show.
Right.
And then we would have been stuck with continuing, you know, $200,000 a month lease payments after that.
Right.
Right. So it was, and to do it in the cloud was around $1 million.
Right.
So it was half the cost. Like legit on a real show.
On a real show.
We did 9.1 million core hours worth of rendering on a walk.
Yeah.
So that's,
and that's not
small.
Trivial. No. Not trivial. The thing is, people, you know, well, we'll talk about the walk in a second because I want to talk about how, like, people don't realize how many visual effects are going to be on that show, but it's going to be incredible. But legit, you guys really, really basically did lot of stuff on the cloud. Do you guys do Nuke on the cloud too?
Yeah.
So it's pretty much everything, right?
Pretty much everything. And the great thing about that is that, you know, so we'll do like a V-Ray render in Katana or Maya, mm-hmm. and then so that happens in the cloud. It gets downloaded. A compositor works with it, and then when the compositor goes to submit their Nuke script, because that render was done in the cloud to begin with, it's still up there. So so the compositor only has to upload his like little 1 megabyte Nuke script, and then it's going. So I was talking before about
So how does that work? I mean, does this stuff just stay cached up there? Is that how it works?
Yeah, And then we've built some smarts into conductors' brains that recognize that even if you've like moved those files around or even renamed them locally, it can tell that it's the same file.
Right.
So it really goes to pretty extreme lengths to avoid transferring data that is already in the cloud.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, that sounds pretty amazing. Okay. So now that we've covered the fact that it costs the right price, now let's talk about some of the other paranoia that happens on CloudStat.
Yeah, let's do it.
So people are always terrified of like, you can't, the MPAA is never going to allow us to do anything on the cloud, which is obviously bullshit because obviously you worked on a legit Sony big Robert Zemeckis film and it was rendered on the cloud. And you've done that a few times, right?
Yeah, and Paramount's been a great supporter of us. I mean,
so why do people think that the studios are never going to go for it?
So I think that one of the reasons is that the data security people at the studios, their entire job is to vet, security at studios, both physically and sort of from a data perspective.
Right.
And rightfully so, they're a little afraid of the cloud. And it's not because the cloud isn't safe or can't be safe, but you can make an unsafe cloud implementation.
Right.
You can do that. And the problem is, like, the normal local way of working has been around for 30, 40 years, right? So there's a box that they have that they can evaluate a studio by. So if you're inside the box, you're fine. If you have anything that falls outside the box, they can spot it immediately and you tell you how to rectify it.
Okay.
With the cloud, there is no box yet because it's so new.
So
it's all kind of the unknown. And so they have nothing by which to evaluate the cloud from a security standpoint. But I know the MPAA is working on creating that box. We're really excited to actually get into a world where that box does exist.
Yep.
So leading up until then, it's really been about having conversations with the studios. It's like, I know there's fear here. Let's talk about it.
Okay.
And at the end of those conversations, everybody always comes away and says, you guys are thinking about all the right things. Go ahead, full speed.
And just to let people know, obviously the data gets encrypted, right? And so
there's two things. One is like the data is encrypted both in transit and at rest. And the way that we built Conductor is it's an application that sits cloud side. So all data transfer and all communication with the cloud happens through Conductor. Mm-hmm. So you're never actually physically accessing the data or the nodes that sit in the cloud on the other side, and they can't get to the outside world either.
Okay.
So having the app be sort of a traffic cop between everything that happens locally in the cloud really helps to like button up security. It's the worst thing that could happen if somebody gets into a node in the cloud and then can wreak havoc with the data and do other stuff.
Sure.
With it, right.
But no one's going to be able to do that.
No one's going to be able to do that.
Right.
The other thing is, like, take Google, for example. They have a team of, like, 500 PhDs that focus on nothing but security all day long, right?
Of course.
And you think about that, and it's absurd to think that any visual effects studio, even the biggest ones, are able to compete with that level of brain power focused specifically on security.
Yes.
So I think that when you take those two things combined of like, hey, let's have like a smart, cloud implementation that uses encryption, all the security technologies out there, and the teams that those people have, it's I would argue that it is an order of magnitude more secure than what most people's local.
Absolutely. And not only that, but it's got to be, let's just talk practically for the MPA, right? Yeah. They've got to go to every freaking studio that's working on every freaking movie and go say, hey, you know what? Let's check out their security and go through this. Now, if you say, I don't have a render on the cloud, it's like, great, I've already certified Google or whatever, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
They've you can do something that they've already certified. So if they certify Google or Amazon or whatever cloud system is out there that they, that people want to use, and they say, all right, if you're using that, you're done. And then they don't have to worry about it. It becomes more efficient for them to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why. So, you know, Atomic Fiction, we developed Conductor for our own use, and it was working so well that we decided that we wanted to release it as a product. So we'll actually be releasing it as a product at the end of the year.
Oh, okay.
And one of the reasons why we decided that we really wanted to do that was to just help get people into the cloud, right?
Right.
But also to do it in a secure way, because the thing that would be the worst for us is like Atomic Fiction as a company is if somebody went out there, made some crappy cloud implementation that either caused a project to fail or a bunch of data to leak or
right.
whatever, it would make our life, you know, beating the cloud drum really, really hard.
Right.
So what kind of we envision Conductor being is like a solution that is like blessed by the studios, by the MPAA.
Mm-hmm.
It's not yet, but we'll get there. And it's just like, yep, you use Conductor. Okay, check. Right.
Right.
So
yeah, same thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, it's not even the cloud providers getting signed off, because that's important too, but it's the framework via which you're using the cloud that signed off too. So it can make things a lot easier for the companies that are having their balls busted,
right?
Because half of what they have to worry about is just like, oh, we use Conductor, check. All right,
right.
Cool, good.
Yeah, well, that's really, really awesome. And I think that's a good way to do it, is make sure that you're using the right products and then everyone trusts that product, right?
Yep.
So, but you're not necessarily satisfied with just trying new things by doing cloud rendering. Obviously, when you did the walk, you decided you wanted to try other new things, such as using Katana and V-Ray together, right?
Yep, that's right.
So that's a big show for you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
You guys used to be kind of like a cool little fly-by-night crazy studio that did cloud rendering.
Yeah.
Did a few shots here and there and did some interesting shows. Now you're doing, you know, 600 shows, right? You got outside vendors you have to use, but you're the primary on it.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's a big show.
Yeah, it was a big show, and in fact, you know, we have a great relationship with Robert Zemeckis,
right.
Which I'm just like always over the moon about, because he was one of the reasons why I got into this business to begin with.
Yeah, we were talking about that yesterday.
Yeah, Back to the Future is just like just blew my mind when I was a kid.
Yep.
So he, we did Flight with him, mm-hmm. which was at that time the biggest movie that we'd done. It was like 400 shots.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came along. He said, "Hey, I want you guys to do The Walk," and I'm like, "Okay, cool, but we can't do all of it."
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, we just had, you know, 50 or 45 people in our Oakland office,
right?
And he's like, "No, I want you to do all of it." I'm like, "Okay, we'll do as much of it as we can, but we're not doing the whole thing."
Right.
And so we ended up deciding to start a Montreal facility.
Yep.
And just because we love that city, mm-hmm. tons of talented artists there.
Yep.
And we were shooting the film in Montreal.
Right.
So I could actually be there to supervise the construction of the facility while we were shooting,
mm-hmm.
Because you have so much spare time when you're on set.
Of course.
At the same time, yeah, we brought Rodeo and UPP and uh-huh. Legend 3D into the mix,
yeah.
to help spread the VFX workload. But
awesome.
it was a big show for us. I mean, we did over 300 shots. But the thing, it doesn't sound like a lot, but the thing is that there were 826 shots in the entire movie, not visual effect shots. Shots.
So those are long,
long,
long shots.
Long shots. So it was really the equivalent of, you know, like 1,000 VFX shots,
right.
For a company.
Yeah, because some of those shots are like, it's got to be in the thousands of frames, right?
Mm-hmm. Easily. Yeah, we had like, you know, 1,400 frame shots.
Nice.
Like, it was definitely, anybody who's worked on a Bob Z show before, we'll kind of snicker. Because it'll be familiar to them.
And then just I can imagine like, oh, I got to render this 1,000 frame shot. I was like, no, don't worry about it. It's all going
to
get rendered.
Yeah, and there's nowhere to hide, you know, to hide crappy CG either. Like,
nope.
You know, because you don't have quick cuts and this, that, and the other. It's
yep.
like the whole point of doing long shots for Bob is, especially in this movie, because these were actually exceptionally long for even for him, mm-hmm. Is that, you know, he wanted The Walk to be an amazing 3D experience.
Right.
And when you have longer shots, your eyes have a chance to like explore the frame.
Of course.
And so by the very like nature of that, that means that people are going to be scrutinizing at a higher level.
Yeah.
So it was creatively challenging in addition to, you know, from a technical standpoint and a rendering standpoint.
Yeah.
Being challenging.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about New York. So yeah. You had to look at New York and you basically had to say what 1974, right?
Yep.
So you had to go back to 1974 New York, and you realized that first of all, the Twin Towers, as we all know, are not there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And on top of that, if you look back, you found some tool you could look back and see what.
Yeah, there's this crazy website that you can go to where you can slide a slider to 1974, and it will make all the buildings that are new since then. Blue, right?
Okay.
So you can kind of get a heat map of Manhattan, of like which buildings we need to focus on, actually, like,
right.
You know, building differently from what is in current day New York. But then when we got into the process of actually building out the city below, we realized that even some of the buildings that were there in 1974 are obscured by new buildings in modern day New York, so you can't even really photograph them to,
right.
You know, to make the CG version.
So you pretty much just had to rebuild 1974 New York,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And so you looked at what they looked like. I mean, what was your reference? How did you...
We just used tons of, you know, photos from back in the day. You know, but everybody was using film, and actually, even some of the most recent World Trade Center tower reference photography. Mm-hmm. Was still using film because,
right.
I mean, we forget now because digital photography is so prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, you know, it was, you know, 15 years ago,
yep.
Everybody was still shooting film.
Yep.
So a lot of the reference that we had was too grainy to just use verbatim. So we took a helicopter above and flew for 2 days over modern day New York.
Mm-hmm.
We had a red Epic with a new Dragon sensor in it, and a gyro stabilized nose mount on the helicopter.
Right.
And we flew all over New York getting whatever reference that we could so that.
But you were also looking at things. You were using the study. It's like,
yeah.
How much do I see traffic?
Mm-hmm.
Do I notice lights changing? Do
yep.
I, yeah.
Yeah. Because so. It's actually, you know, being 1,400 feet above the ground is kind of a unique place to be, right?
Yep.
And so. A lot of the things that you intuitively think you should see, you don't. So it's easy for the city to look dead
mm-hmm.
below, but it's also easy for it to look small if things are too much stuff is happening below.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. The helicopter was a great way for us to get ground ourselves in that.
Yeah.
But the other thing that it did that was really kind of like unexpected and surprising for me is that I just remember it vividly, like the first day that we took off and we got special clearance to hover right over ground zero mm-hmm. at 1,400 feet. So like where Philippe Petit actually did his illegal walk between the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to that point, I look down through the side window of the helicopter, and it was just like the hairs on the back of my neck just went up,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's like I'm here, right, where this guy was with no safety gear, no nothing on mm-hmm. on a high wire. But it was like this like feeling of like mixed awe and utter terror, right? And that emotion was something that was like really unexpected for me. I didn't think that I'm not afraid of heights or any of that kind of stuff, but
I'm terrified.
I love this movie.
I know. And it's 3D. Thank you very much.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was able to kind of bring that emotion, that recollection of that sensation back to the team,
yeah.
and really evaluate every shot in the movie against that.
Just yeah, like does it feel as like this?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, do I get that experience?
Yeah. So that was really, really priceless.
Yeah.
And the 3D on the movie is phenomenal. Legend 3D did the conversion on it, and
I saw some of the we're actually good friends with the guys at Legend 3D.
Cool,
did Justin came by because he's been doing some work with us in terms of his VR work.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But they were showing me some of the, you know, some of their work and they've done on the trailer for The Walk.
Yeah.
To see the trailer of The Walk in 3D. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. They did such a great job over there. And Jared, who's their 3D supervisor, he kind of served as a stereographer on the show as well. Mm-hmm. And it, I will never do a show, in native stereo again.
No, the conversion used to be a dirty word. I don't think it's a dirty word anymore. Yeah. In fact, I think it's the preferred way to go because you have way more flexibility, control, certainly flexibility when you're shooting, but also like flexibility after you're shooting in the sense that you can control how deep things look or everything that's happening. So
yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that, a lot of people, and this is the case with the high frame rate films that are out there too. I think that a lot of people make the mistake of confusing cinema with reality. Mm-hmm. And so that's why a lot of people are put off by the high frame rate stuff is because it feels more real, but you're not there to be in reality. You're there to watch a movie.
Yeah.
And the same is true with shooting native stereo where it's if you're force feeding somebody exactly what two cameras see, you're ignoring the fact that when your eyes are actually perceiving the world,
right?
They're doing a lot of filtering and a lot of crazy stuff that is not just literally what your eyes are seeing. And when you're doing a stereo conversion, you can kind of emulate the feeling that you want people to have, the cinematic feeling of what you're trying to convey, and do some of that filtering for people. Mm-hmm. So it's a great creative tool. It's not a shortcut. It's actually a tool.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's really interesting. And I will have to see it, and I will have to see it in stereo, and it'll be awesome. And I'll face my fears, which is I think the whole point, right?
Yeah. It's a good safe way.
It's a good safe way to do it.
Right? Yeah, you should also do, which you can do today, if you go to the VR Village here at SIGGRAPH.
Oh, yeah.
We worked with a company called Create and Sony to make a VR experience where you actually are on the top of the Twin Towers and you get to step out on the wire.
Wow.
Yeah, and you're wearing a Morpheus and it's it's absolutely freaking terrifying.
Well, great. Well, I think it was a really interesting thing you did, but you also obviously recreated New York. You used V-Ray. You've been using V-Ray since the beginning of Atomic Fiction, right?
Yep.
And we've been working to make sure that what you're doing on the cloud is working well.
Yep.
Obviously, it's been one of our things. But you also used Katana at this point, right? Yeah. You decided to switch over to Katana because you felt it was the best way to manage all of those shots that you wanted mm-hmm. to do and sort of create a better tied-around system. And so what was it like to do V-Ray and Katana?
It was great. I mean, the end result is exactly what we wanted out of it.
Sure.
And it was definitely a challenge because we were changing a lot of stuff. I mean, I talked about starting a new studio in Montreal to do this show.
Yeah, but you're not afraid to do these things. You're starting a new studio. You're going to use V-Ray and Katana. You're going to do it on the cloud.
Yep.
So.
just like you said, we always have people say are you guys crazy? That'll never work. And it's that's a great thing about the team that we have is we always find a way. And are really happy that we did those things, right?
Yeah.
So, Katana, and we also switch our whole asset management pipeline to a shotgun based one. So
okay,
we
there you go.
Manage cross site stuff. Yep. So, the implementation process of Katana was definitely, not an instant one. It took us a couple months of, getting it up and running and, making sure that, was integrating with our asset manager and that, that we could do all the things that we wanted to from a workflow perspective with V-Ray.
Yep.
And at the end of the day, it was the classic example of we do a bunch of upfront work and now all of a sudden everything is just lightning fast.
Right.
We had a super small team. We had, a team of four lighters doing all of the lighting and rendering for New York and the Twin Towers for the show, right?
Wow.
And so, we had, it was sort of a perfect use case for Katana because we have a lot of shots that are all using the same assets, right? And the mm-hmm. different lighting scenarios and stuff, but the same base assets. So we could create a template that was really light for the artist and easy to work with, but had immense amount of complexities under the hood. And because of the way that Katana can kind of just go out and live reference sort of external dependencies, we're able to have like our one of our TDs or our lead lighter go in and make a change and then instantly populate it to everyone else on the team and just have it happen seamlessly.
Right.
So it was a great pipelineable show. Mm-hmm. And then V-Ray just, you know, killed it on the rendering front. I mean, I was terrified about the towers because they're, you know, they're this anodized aluminum that's
right.
Like,
was it a bit something you were like, no, it's hard to figure that out. Well, V-Ray's done buildings before.
Yeah, V-Ray's done buildings before. And, you know, the challenge with the towers is that everybody has a different idea of what they look like. Mm-hmm. They have a different memory of what they
look
like.
Because it looks different every time because of the reflectivity, right?
Yep, exactly. It's like a chameleon, right?
Right.
It just takes on, you know, whatever's around it. And so
some people remember it dark. Some people remember it almost white.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. And it's so we kind of had to make sure that the materials on the tower were responding in the exact right way, so that when we changed the skies and when we changed the lighting, they responded appropriately. We absolutely like love the GGX BRDF in V-Ray 3. It's just like, I mean, I force people to use it on like all kinds of stuff now
because it's
so awesome. But it really made the difference between the towers looking like CG metal buildings versus like those things are freaking real.
Right. Well, it puts in all the micro faceting, right? It puts mm-hmm. in all the details that think people forget are there sometimes,
yep.
you know?
Yep.
So it's really kind of a powerful tool.
And
do that.
Absolutely. And the thing I always like to joke, it's like there's when we're doing visual effects work, there's sometimes those moments where something's not looking real. And then all of a sudden it is, and you kind of can't know why.
Right.
I know that's kind of like, you know, not a good thing for me as a visual effects supervisor to say, cause I should know why, but like,
no, it happens all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that's the number one thing with the Uncanny Valley. I know it's mm-hmm. wrong, but I don't know why.
Yep. and it's because of things like micro facets. Like you can't see them, right?
Right.
They just affect the way that things behave.
Right.
To light. So that's why it is such a powerful tool, is cause it's doing a thing that you can't really emulate without, you know, really diving that deep,
right.
know, to the micro level.
Yeah, exactly. So it's pretty interesting. You know, when we for the WikiHuman project, I don't know if you know anything,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, when we actually scanned faces down to 10 microns.
Wow.
So
that's crazy.
Well, the ICT guys did, but we have the data that we're using, and once we had that data, then we could stop using GGX or CookTorrents or whatever we're going to do. Because mm-hmm. once we had that data, we actually displaced the skin down to mm-hmm. that level. And then we were able to use Fong and it still looked good. I'm just going to say, but not everyone's going to scan something at 10 microns, right?
Right.
Including it. So things that emulate microfacets are perfect for that because they'll give you that look. Again, like you said, I didn't realize it was even there to start with, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's important. Yeah.
And I think that's like a great it's a fascinating story about scanning at that level. And I think it's a great example of like you can get great results by going like, you know, just like down to the nth degree.
Mm-hmm.
But the great thing about things like GGX is that it helps you get 99.999, like imperceptibly close to that.
Well, you're not going to scan that material.
No.
So you want something that's going to emulate all that stuff. And if you can do it in a BRDF, then do it in a BRDF. So it
exactly.
totally makes sense. Yeah.
And even in, you know, I was talking to somebody who's in a totally different industry in scientific computing. They mm-hmm. they deal with folding proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even in scientific computing, they use blends of physical and statistical models in order to get results quickly. And that's like,
right.
they're literally saving lives, right? They're developing drugs and stuff like that.
Sure.
And so, you know, I think that we are like constantly in need of reminders to like, yeah, we have to keep doing that in the visual effects process.
Right.
Because like I said, the Twin Towers kind of terrified me because they're this material that's reflective, and how long is this going to take to render? And oh my God, are we going to be stuck with the hero asset in each scene being 7 hours a frame?
Right.
And it wasn't. Right. It was like we were at an hour a frame, mm-hmm. usually after baking the GI.
So, yeah. Well, that's so you were an hour a frame generally on those shots. Right?
On the buildings, yeah. Yeah. And then the city was another hour, and so I think cumulatively, you know, each frame was, you know, probably 3 hours on average for everything that was in it. Which was
reasonable. And that's, you know, those are legit 2K frames.
And those, and you know, with like, you know, plenty of AOVs and,
right.
And, you know, just, and we broke, it actually would have been faster if we hadn't broken them all out, but we wanted the ability to kind of, you know, tweak things as we went.
Right.
So yeah, it was fantastic.
Wow. Okay.
And that's including all the cars and all the, you know, we had like live rendered cars and just street props, hot dog stands, like all that kind of stuff. So
did you use a lot of proxies and stuff or instancing? Or?
We did a little bit, but actually not, we didn't really have time to set that up.
Wow.
To the level that we wanted to. And Katana, you know, kind of makes it easy to manage that data without having to, suffer from it when you're interactive.
Right.
So we kind of did a bunch of testing and said, do we need to dive to that level for the rendering? And, because of how well the cloud was performing for us, we actually didn't need to do that.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's pretty bold.
Yeah.
That's...
So we optimized in a lot of ways. As soon as we hit our target render times, we said, all right, we're going to stop and focus on making it look great.
Oh, wow. Okay. Really cool. Let's, we're coming up on an hour, so we'll wrap this up soon. But before we go, I want to talk a little bit about the email you got from Robert Zemeckis that you put on the presentation. What did the email say? So
yeah.
People know.
He called me.
Oh, he called you.
Yeah. And I knew that he was going to be watching the movie, that day. It was the final color corrected sound mix.
Sure, sure.
Film. And he said, Kev, I just watched the movie and I gotta tell you, like, this is the most spectacular effects film I have ever made.
And that's from Robert Zemeckis.
That's from Robert Zemeckis.
Right.
Yeah, it's just like...
The guy who did Roger Rabbit, the guy who did Back to the Future.
Yep.
And the one that I would think was more, like, the Forrest Gump to me is a very important movie. Because mm-hmm. Forrest Gump is the movie where suddenly... there was all this visual effects that you didn't realize was there,
yeah.
Right? That was the one that sort of did that. It wasn't like, check out, you know, this Transformer robot, whatever, which is, you know, mm-hmm. that's got its place, but this was like full of invisible effects, right?
Yeah.
As is The Walk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most of The Walk, you're not going to be thinking about the fact that most of the city you're seeing, or almost all of it, is visual effects, so.
Yeah, I mean, that it's so true, and it's funny, the, you know, I heard that Rick Carter, who's been Bob Zemeckis' production designer for a long time in past movies,
mm-hmm.
He didn't work on this movie, but he was involved in the pre-pro, because we actually were in pre-pro on this movie for like almost 7 years.
Wow.
It's crazy. But he refers to Forrest Gump as like the healing movie of that generation, you know, mm-hmm. after Vietnam and all that stuff. And he equates The Walk to... that as sort of the healing movie of this generation, with, you know, the Twin Towers,
right?
So they sort of like thematically almost they have a lot of similarities, and I think that I think that The Walk is going to affect people in somewhat the same way as what Forrest Gump did.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I think it will be a very emotional show for sure, and
yeah.
I think that's really awesome.
Yeah, and it's a great, like, genuinely really good film. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who plays Philippe Petit, is...
Well, he's awesome.
He's a rock star.
So Are you leaving soon to go back to San Francisco?
This afternoon. So I just had a kid 2.5 weeks ago.
Really?
So, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Well, congratulations.
So, thank you very much.
I can't believe you did. Oh, well,
slightly guilt-stricken for being at SIGGRAPH, but, you know.
Yeah, I bet.
I will atone for my sins.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been so great to have you here and great to have you talk over at V-Ray Days, but I'm glad we were able to do this podcast because we can share it with a lot more people and sort of talk about that. So,
well, thanks for the great conversation. And
absolutely.
Awesome.
All right. So what we always say at the end of the podcast is that we let the last bucket drop because it's like the last rendering. But you don't even see buckets because they're all in the cloud.
Yeah.
So you're just like, what's a bucket?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys.